Brooke, Global Vice Chair at Ernst & Young, and it is just my absolute pleasure to welcome you here to what I am sure will be a very insightful discussion on the environment and civilization. We are extraordinarily lucky this morning to have with us C.K. Prachlahad, who is the Distinguished Professor of Corporate Strategy at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. He's been honored for his contributions with awards and has been a member of the UN Blue Ribbon Commission on Private Sector and Development. Professor Prachlahad has worked with senior management of many of the world's top companies. His current work addresses a complex emerging market, the world's poor, and the innovative business models that will help to end world poverty. He's authored many, many books, but his latest, and many of you I'm sure have read it, is The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, Eradicating Poverty Through Profit. This was an instant bestseller, and it was selected as one of the best books of the year by The Economist, Fast Company, and Amazon.com. In his book, C.K. states that companies must revolutionize how we do business in developing countries if both sides of the economic equation are to prosper. And I live that, and I believe it. Please join me in welcoming Professor Prachlahad as he addresses globalization for better or worse, civilization, and the environment. And before C.K. comes to the podium, if I could just ask you to turn off your cell phones and your PDAs, because they do interfere with the sound system in the room. So if you could, please turn those off. Professor Prachlahad.
Thank you so much. Some of you must be wondering why the title is different. It's the same topic. I just shortened the title so that I think we can talk about this without a mouthful as a title. I just want to start with the inherent tension. When we talk about globalization, which has been the topic that has been discussed quite a lot here, or inclusive growth, call it harmonious society in China or inclusive growth, or 50 billion people in this country who are underbanked and poor. It does not matter where you look at. There is a democratization of commerce that I think we need to deal with. Being inclusive growth, and I include 5 billion people in that space, and ecologically sustainable growth. Those three, I think we can deal with it. In quantitative terms, we can agree to disagree, but at least we can measure those. What I find the most insidious problem is what is on the right, the ideological battles that inform both globalization, either for or against, or ecological development, both for and against, and therefore caught in between are 5 billion people. So what I like to do is to talk a little bit about the context of globalization, what does it inclusive growth mean, and then come and start looking at the impacts it has on ecology and sustainable development. I do not believe that we can get to a point where we can talk about sustainable development intelligently without dealing with global poverty and without dealing with globalization. It is fine to talk about carbon trading, greenhouse gases, all the good things that we have talked about in the United States, and we have to do a lot. But if you ignore 5 billion people, the environmental degradation will be beyond belief. So my bottom line, and I'll tell you the bottom line up front, all the development models we have used in the West are inappropriate in dealing with global development in the long term. That is the starting point. You can't fine-tune these developmental models. We have to fundamentally rethink those development models. That's the bottom line. But I'm going to spend some time looking at this issue because this is what I call behind the curtain. Well-meaning people starting with totally different ideological bent can destroy the very capacity in our society to come to a consensus. And that, I think, is the issue we have to deal with head-on. It's a lot easier to talk about people living on less than $2 a day or the impacts of globalization. So I'm going to get through it very, very fast. And then I hope you'll have enough time to really discuss how can we as leaders and responsible citizens bring in a consensus building process that cuts through ideology and builds pragmatism and choice for ordinary people. And that, I think, is the basic thesis for today. I want to start with the context. So there is a lot of discussion about whether globalization is good or bad for the poor, or for the rich for that matter. In fact, I never thought I'm going to live in a place where, at least in my lifetime, people in the United States would be concerned about China and India. 20 years ago, that was not even a distant hope that that will happen. But it is happening all the time. And if you listen to Lou Dobbs, it looks like suddenly the world has totally changed. This is an interesting way to phrase the question. If you phrase the question this way, you have to take sides on whether it's good or bad. And I think the answer is it is good and bad. If you look at what has happened, globalization has helped rapid movement of people away from $1 a day, both in China and India. Just in those two countries, more than 300 million people have moved away from abject poverty. That's the good news. First time in human history in such a short time. The not so good news is there is tremendous income inequalities. So I can look at both sides. I can say poor people have to be better off today, 300 million of them. I can also say there is more social unrest because income inequalities have become extremely dangerous in most countries. Just to give you an idea, the Gini coefficient, as you know, is one measure of income inequality. If you look at the United States, it is a very unequal society, and it's getting there. And we need to come to terms with the fact that we are as unequal. Look at what has happened in China. In 1985-86, the Gini coefficient was 22. They were very poor, that they're a more equal society. Now they are very rich, or getting to be rich. They're becoming very unequal. It is one measure of finding out what is the distribution of wealth. If everybody had the same, then the Gini coefficient will be very low. If you get to 50 or 60, that means there are some very rich people and some very poor people. You look at the total population and look at what is the differences in income. This is just a statistical measure. And this is widely used by economists. It's not necessarily a perfect measure. It's widely used. Okay? And if you have 47, it means it's very unequal. If you look at Brazil, it's a very unequal society. So is South Africa. So one of the interesting questions is, what happens in 20 years when income inequalities become so pronounced in China or in India, or in South Africa for that matter? So this is an important question, because if you look at China, the big debate in China is ecology and building a harmonious society. That is a code word for how do we deal with income inequalities. If you look at the debate in India, it is about building an inclusive society, which is a code word for how to deal with income inequalities. And it's the same here. Even though we don't recognize it, it's going to get worse. So, and I think it has a huge implication on how we run our societies. If you look at Human Development Index and the quality of life, it also varies all over the map. So you can ask an interesting question: wide variations in GDP, wide variations in Human Development Index, but wide variations in income inequality as well. So the real question that I think most countries are debating is, how should we increase income so that number of people in abject poverty get reduced? Or should we deal with income inequality so there is more social cohesion, but not necessarily reduction of poverty? Or do we have to worry about income mobility, where poor people have a chance and they have a hope that they can get out of their poverty trap? So my orientation, obviously, is to work on 1 and 3. If you work on 2 prematurely, you'll get socialism back again. Because there's one way of equalizing everybody at low level. And I don't think that should be our goal, is to provide mobility for people to move up and also have strategies for reducing income. In the short term, it's going to create across the world tremendous income inequalities and social tensions. And that is why the debate about globalization is so interesting, because some people see income inequality and say globalization is bad. I can see 1 and 3 and say globalization is good. And both are perfectly legitimate interpretations. And I think we need to come to terms with what do we have to deal with and how do we moderate the influences of rapid economic development. So that's one reason why globalization must be part of the context. The second, I think, is to look at how big is the market for poor people or how large is the problem that we're dealing with. And I think we used to talk a lot about the bottom of the pyramid. Now there is a fairly detailed study of 140 countries done by IFC and World Resources Institute. They look at this and say people living less than 3,000 purchasing power dollars per capita, which is about $500 or $600 depending on the country, they represent a $5 trillion opportunity. And this is what the pyramid looks like. Most people on between $400 to $600, and it's huge. And this is how they spend the money, and I want to come back to it. If you look at it, primarily 70% of it is food. And I think we want to come back and look at what the implications are. When everybody starts eating food at the levels that are appropriate for a healthy life, what does it mean for agriculture? What does it mean for the devastation of the environment? What does it mean for fishing? And I think we want to come back and ask that question. And then housing and energy, you can see health, which is fairly significant, and transportation, and, of course, information technology. So we'll come back to it because this market is big, it's growing rapidly, and it will have significant impacts on how we live and what business models will work. So in my work, I start with a very different question. I don't ask whether globalization is good or bad, because then you have to take sides. I ask the question how to make globalization work for the benefit of all. Because globalization to me is like gravity. No point in denying gravity, but we can defy gravity and make a plan. So the question is, how do you look at gravity and defy gravity and make globalization work for all? But if you want to make it work for all, we must start with a point of view. And that is the point of view that I think we should have in order to deal with the problems, complex problems that we have. Just imagine if we start with a simple question. Why can't every person have the right to the benefits of globalization, both as a micro-consumer and as a micro-producer? And our job is to make every person have the access to the benefits of globalization. If we start with that, then the problem reduces to something very simple. Every person as a consumer, afford world-class product and services. In other words, we can't ask 5 billion people not to have a higher standard of living. Higher standard of living means more energy, more water, more resources. So we need to come to terms with the question of what happens if every consumer, all 6.5 billion people, even if I don't believe we'll have 9.5 billion people projecting the population growth, let us assume 6.5 to 7 billion people, start living the way that 1 billion people live today in terms of comfort, sanitation, health, and food, then what is the implication? The second is, what if every person becomes a micro-producer? And we'll come back and ask, what does a micro-producer mean? Can you have two women with two buffaloes in villages build a global company? The answer to that is yes. If you go to India, you find Amul, which works with almost 10,000 villages, 2.2 million farmers. They bring two buffaloes and milk every day in the morning. It's collected in a collection center, refrigerated vans take it to a processing plant, and they have a global business. You can buy their products in the United States. $1 billion of a business built on the backs of ordinary people living in villages through a cooperative and a modern logistics system. And they process about 7 million kilograms of milk per day. It's the largest system in the world. It is possible to do it. That's what I mean by micro producers. Individual producers are small. Collectively, they can be world class and world scale. So inclusion of the 4 billion underserved in the market economy and consumers shape their own experiences, and I think both as micro producers and micro consumers. And it can be a big market. We can do something different. Have people seen these pictures before? It's sort of interesting, isn't it? Look at the people using cell phones. End of this year, between 2.5 to 3 billion people would be connected. Hopefully, in the next 5 years, 4.5 billion people would be connected. For the first time in human history, 4 billion people will be connected through cell phones and very soon through the internet. You think that's going to change the way people think of themselves? You think they are going to see movies of what happens in the United States and in Europe and in Japan, and you think their aspirations are going to change? Or I think it's going to remain the same? So in other words, connectivity is going to make the world different. And everybody's going to have the same aspirations, just like we have. They are going to have the same aspirations. The only good news is we can crack the code, 2.5 billion connected today. And not only are people connected, it has also built one of the world's largest markets. Just in India, 6.5 million cell phones are sold every month, not every year, every month. And the market cap of four companies, which didn't exist 10 years ago, is $75 billion. Very small. Actually, if you look at, go back to the chart, ICT was very small, maybe understated, maybe a little bit larger, but nothing like food, nothing like health or education or housing or transportation. This market, which is one of the largest, just in India, four companies are $75 billion in market cap, and that's not a bad number. Imagine what can happen to, my starting point is, even if you convert 2 billion people into global consumers, and include them in globalization, it may be the largest engine of growth the world has ever seen. That's the good news. The bad news is we have to deal with the consequences of rapid growth on ecology and sustainability. And I think that is the reason why I say all discussion about sustainability, ignoring 5 billion poor, does not matter, because they are going to have a significant influence. And therefore, I'm going to come back and argue that may be the place where innovations will come from, not from the United States or Canada or Germany. There may be a lot more discussion here, but innovation is inevitable there. That has happened in all the other businesses. Take cell phones. The innovations are taking place in Thailand, in Philippines, and in India. How many of you can make small transactions using an SMS message? You buy a six-pack of beer and you send an SMS message and finish the transaction. That's common practice in Philippines, and in India it is increasing. So we are behind in technology, and we don't want to accept it because it just hurts our sensitivities to say we are behind. And the Filipinos are ahead. And the interesting thing is, if I'm a Filipino working in Dubai, I can send an SMS message and make a small remittance to my family in the small village in Philippines. That is also possible today. And if you go and tell Filipinos that's how it can be done, it's not news. In my class, it is news, because we don't know how to do it here. For those of you who just travel around the world, come back to New York, try to use the cell phone. The systems don't work, but they seem to work everywhere else. So, in other words, the palm of poverty alleviation is complex. It has become an ideological battleground. That is why we don't see these opportunities. What is the problem? There is a public sector, aid agencies, and multilaterals. They believe there is a universal solution. Last year, it was the year of microfinance in UNDP. So maybe next year, it is a year of small and medium enterprises. So one solution for the whole world. All poor people are the same. is nothing can be farther from the truth. There is so much granularity and variety in problems and opportunities. So that doesn't work. Civil society organizations put social justice over economic development. And therefore, what happens? You get very small, localized, brilliant experiments that are not scalable. To give you an idea, I once met with maybe about 20 very important leaders in the NGO community in Latin America. We all sat together to discuss what can be done with poverty. It's a fascinating discussion because they had never met each other, even though they belong to the same organization. They're from different countries. And I asked them to go introduce themselves so that I know what they do and how they manage their lives. Out of 20, 11 or 12 of them were involved in prenatal care and care of young children. They never talked to each other. They always invented their own ways. And I think prenatal care seems to be universal, more or less. The social context may be different, but the problems are not. The technical problems are not. They never discuss the technical problems. So one of the things that you find is highly segmented experimentation from NGOs is brilliant for developing new business models, but there is too much redundancy built into it. And that's an important part. And then, of course, personal philanthropy have very personal agendas. And especially when the philanthropic groups are becoming larger, their personal agendas can have a significant impact. If Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation decides malaria is important, it can switch the priorities of many countries in Africa rapidly. So building of capabilities over a sustained period of time becomes very difficult when you depend on philanthropy. And then, of course, there is the private sector, large firms. So the problem is the woman sitting in the middle with two buffaloes have become the battleground for ideology. In other words, let us not make the poor a constituency rather than look at poor as a problem to be solved and a problem that we can help solve. Because that, I think, is the important issue, and I want to come back to it again, because as long as we have this problem, no solution will work. I'll give you a very simple example. I, as a large American bank, can go and give microfinance and lend money to poor people at 18%. I'll have newspaper articles in Wall Street Journal saying how this company is ripping off the poor. Local moneylender giving the money at 300% gets no attention. Now, I always ask NGOs, whose side are you on? 300% is okay, because 300% is highly fragmented. Nobody will publish an article. But Citibank is an interesting target. So what happens? Most large companies shy away from doing things that they know how to do. And the reason is they don't want their reputation to be destroyed. So the best thing is not to do anything, which is also harmful. So why is this so important to look at poverty and environmental damage? I'm going to primarily use data from the World Resources Institute, and I'm somewhat biased because I'm also a member of their board, and I'm going to use mostly data from a brilliant economist there called Janet Ranganathan, and I'm going to use some of the stuff that she put together. In other words, if you look at nature, there are types of ecosystem services that nature provides. The first is provisioning. Goods produced are provided by the ecosystem. That's food. Across the world, you have. So there is, nature provides the bounty, and that's important for us to recognize. It is not just the environmental damage. It is protecting the environment so that we continue to get good harvests, good levels of food, and high levels of productivity, and so on. The second is what I call regulating. Benefits obtained from regulation of the natural processes, and that is really helping us from deadly diseases, urbanization, urban sprawl, tsunami, and so on. And finally, cultural, which is having a good time enjoying nature. So the type of ecosystem services are quite interesting. So what World Resources Institute did in the Millennium Assessment findings, they looked at 24 different categories. And they find that out of 24 categories of provisioning, regulating, and cultural, at least 16 of them are in great danger. That's not a good scorecard. If you look at provisioning, we have enhanced crops, livestock, and aquaculture, and carbon sequestration in regulating. So that's the good news. The bad news is fisheries, if you look at foods, fuel, genetic resources, biochemicals, freshwater, climate regulation, erosion regulation, water purification, whole bunch of things that have been degraded and destroyed in many cases. And the mix is timber and fiber regulation, some water regulation. It's neither here nor there, but it's okay. This is not a very good scorecard. So I thought I will take something very specific and say what the scorecard looks like. This is a picture of the world. If you look at what has happened, 30% of the landscape that is cultivated or cultivated, increased cultivation, was done in the last 30 years, 40 years. In other words, we are spending more energy and time in creating new areas for cultivation in the last 50 years rather than the last 200 years. What is the implication of this? And you can see where the cultivation is getting to be very intense. It's all in poor areas. But it is very closely connected with the amount of nitrogen that is left into the rivers. Right? We use more and more fertilizer. See what is happening here. There's not a single river that is not polluted with nitrogen. And if you look at the dark browns, which are all in poor areas, all of China, most of India, most of the Middle East, some Africa, a lot of it in Latin America, and of course, enough of it in the United States, it's almost 80% of the increase in nitrogen flows in rivers since 1990. It's not. That's because people are starting to eat better. And they want to focus on agriculture. They want to get better yields. They put more nitrogen. I could have done the same thing for pesticides. It would have been even worse. There is absolutely no control on the use of pesticides in these countries. They think that it is good for productivity. So if the water is getting polluted this way, it is because improving people's lives in these countries is going to create global damage. This is the fishing of Atlantic cod. You can see what happened. 60s, we overfished, and then it's gone. A number of tons landed. Now, you've seen a lot of these pictures before, so this is not something new. But what is interesting is, if you look at what has happened, you can take mangrove forests, wonderful mangrove forests, convert them into shrimp farms in Thailand, and then you get devastation. 5 years, you use the land for fish farming. And for example, I remember 30 years ago, shrimp was once in a way. Now, every party, you have shrimp. Where does the shrimp come from? So somebody is growing them, cultivating that shrimp, and at least I want to give you a bad feeling when you eat shrimp. But it's important because if you look at what has happened, we took that. It is not, I'm not coming from bleeding heart liberal and saying destruction of mangroves is dangerous. No. You destroy the mangroves, you cannot stop hurricanes. And 50% of the major cities are located within 30 to 40 miles of the coast. And the last tsunami hit in Indonesia, there is proof that if you have mangrove forests, it dampens the floods dramatically. So protecting the mangrove forest is a lot more than just beauty. If you look at what has been done, is looking at poverty and ecosystem service, looking at satellite maps, you can see poverty rates in one part of Kenya. But the interesting thing is, if you combine poverty with development of surface water, where 70% of the people need surface water, and the pollution of surface water, you get a deadly picture. This has just happened to be in Kenya. But the methodology is available using satellite maps, looking at poverty maps, looking at deforestation, and looking at water resources on top of it. This is a deadly picture when you see one. I took the less deadly one, which is in Kenya, but 75% of the households rely on surface water. They're poor. There is no surface water. The water is extremely polluted. Therefore, they get very sick. So we are building a huge problem. So the environmental issue for me is not something that you can dissociate from health and, more importantly, with poverty. So it's the same maps for different parts of Kenya. Now let us look at mangrove because it's sort of interesting. That's what it used to look like. Now let's look at what happens. So if you look at keep mangrove as a mangrove, you get probably about $90-$100 per hectare in timber products, timber and non-timber products, but you get $2,000 if you convert that 1 hectare into shrimp farming. Good news or bad news? Because this is only looking at out-of-pocket costs. On the other hand, so you can do all the timber and non-timber products only, convert into shrimp farm, the net present value per hectare, because I cannot say anything as a business school professor without net present values. Okay. That's a very simplistic view. Now you look at fisheries and nursery because mangroves are natural fisheries. So that may be additional $70. But if you look at coastal protection and impute the cost of coastal protection, suddenly the picture changes. And then you take the shrimp farming and take the subsidies out, it's not as interesting. If you take the pollution costs out, and then if you get the restoration costs in, suddenly you look at a very different picture. Mangrove, including coastal protection, is significantly more interesting, purely economically, compared to converting it into a shrimp farm. Does it make sense? Because I'm taking the total cost, including environmental degradation and restoration and the protection of... In fact, actually, in Katrina also, you can say we destroyed the mangrove areas, and I think that we are going to pay the price. And all over Southeast Asia and all over Africa, this is a huge problem. Yep.
Is the benefit of coastal protection an avoided cost from potential losses, or is there an actual flow of funds that can be yielded to make that?
It's not a flow of fund when you don't destroy the mangrove forest. On the other hand, if you destroy it and you get a tsunami or a flood, and then you have to restore the city or part of the villages, that is the total cost per hectare. And in fact, in some dense areas, it could be significantly more. This is only taking to show the methodology in one area in southern Thailand. So you can ask, so what? I believe that one line conclusion for me is poverty alleviation, sustainable development, inclusive growth are intimately interlinked. You cannot, and I can give you more examples, but that's not the point. I just wanted to give you some examples to illustrate this relationship. That means our current development models, energy, water, packaging, and waste per capita are inappropriate. What would happen if we use the same level of packaging in China, Africa, and India, and Brazil, and Mexico? And people still need sanitation. People still need food. Because one way of preserving food is to get processed food. That means packaging. And therefore, we have to deal with the problems of packaging. Right? So very seldom we worry about packaging and the toxic effects of packaging has on Earth. For example, does someone know what happens to all the PCs that we use and laptops? Any idea? All the Xerox machines that we use are copying compounds. Most of them are not biodegradable. So packaging, whether it's not just plastic and paper, all kinds of packaging, semiconductors and so on, and certainly plasma TVs, and I think at least I have a friend who knows a lot about plasma TVs and TVs in general. So in other words, new breakthroughs in innovations is not an option. So I'm going to argue that the emerging markets must become the source of innovation because that's where the problems are. That's where we can find the solution. We cannot find the solution in the United States because we have a huge install base. There is a huge problem of changing the install base. There is absolutely no reason why emerging countries must go through the same development model as the United States and Europe, pay the price, and then correct it. The question is, why can't they bypass and leapfrog? And what is it that we need to do in order to leapfrog? That, I think, is an interesting question. And that is where I think there is a huge opportunity for us not only to innovate, but maybe we always assume innovations will come from the top of the pyramid to the rest of the world. Maybe we can reverse it. And at least most of my work has been asking the question, can I innovate at the bottom of the pyramid and get that back into the top of the pyramid? At least that's an open question, and I want to leave you with that question. Now, you can ask me legitimately, CK, that's all fine, but do you have an example? So I'll give a very, very quick example because it's not easy to argue a point theoretically, so I figured that maybe a short example would help. So I believe if you want to innovate, you must have clear criteria up front in these markets. One, it must be affordable to the poor. That means you have to cut the cost by 1/10, 1/50th, something of that kind, not 5 or 10%. But it must be world-class product and services because people will not buy watered-down versions. And a new market-based ecosystem is what we have to create. We have to get ecologically sustainable high-tech solutions, new business models, and checks and balances on the private sector so that social institutions, civil society works very closely with the private sector. It must have social collateral, it must be scalable, and it must be profitable, otherwise people will not invest. So that looked like a very onerous set of criteria. So let me take energy because it's quite interesting. That's the market for energy in poor countries, Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe, and Latin America. Asia is big. It's not surprising at all because of the number of people. And most people use biomass. 70% of India uses biomass. In other words, very regressive fuels, not progressive fuels. It has pollution. The pollution inside the hut or the home is higher than the pollution outside. So 2 million, 3 million women and children get respiratory disease. It's a huge problem. It's not just an energy problem. It's a health problem as well. This is how the share of household spending on energy. You can see the perversion of the logic. The poor people spend more money on energy. They have bad fuel, regressive fuel, and they spend more money. And of course, when they get rich, they go to electricity, which creates a different problem. Somebody else burns coal in a centralized place and creates energy, but at least it's not kerosene and biomass. And cooking is a major need for energy. It's not just lighting and running factories. So this is how they cook. Anybody seen this at all? That's the most difficult thing for you to come to terms with because people really get hurt inside the hut. Cooking every day, 4 hours, it's a difficult job. So if you go through the process of looking at how the customers use energy, get consumer insights, and then develop a core delivery system, I won't go into how to do it. It's fairly simple. In fact, I say in developing countries, use the constraints as a given. Don't innovate without constraints. Use the constraints as a given and innovate inside the constraints, not outside. In other words, you can't wish away the problem that safety standards, ecologically sensible solutions are critical. It must be scalable as well. So I've been working with BP, which doesn't get a good set of marks in the U.S. recently, but BP has been very concerned about alternate sources of energy. So we said, let's target the rural poor. But the rural poor have extreme variety in cooking habits. Anybody who has traveled in India from north to south, east to west, The food is totally different. The habits of cooking are totally different. You can't give them one choice. And the choice of fuels is based on cooking habits as well as availability of funds for the family and access to biomass. So we need very flexible systems. So after about a year's worth of effort, we came out with a stove which will use biomass and LPG simultaneously. The housewife can decide which one to use. If she wants to make a cup of tea, it's LPG. If she wants to cook a food for seven people, she can use biomass. But biomass was pelletized, and we increased the energy efficiency of the typical stove that they use from 10% of biomass to almost 60%. And it's totally pelletized, absolutely smoke-free, so at least we remove the health hazard totally. And it's affordable. It's less than $20 to buy, and she can buy biomass pellets made in the village clusters, totally decentralized production of biomass. So you can get 1 kilogram bags in the supply chain for new pelletizers. They had to build a new manufacturing and logistics for the stove. And there is also an LPG supply chain, highly decentralized storage. And almost all the selling is done by NGOs in local villages with local entrepreneurs. They have a deep stake in saving forests and also in making life easy for themselves. So at least we can say destruction of the forest now at least is one-fifth of what it used to be for the same amount of cooking. Now you can ask, can you eliminate it all? The answer is yes, if there is enough money. So what we find interesting is people start with biomass and LPG. They move totally to LPG when they become more affluent. But LPG has other problems in India in terms of safety. So there is still work in process. But the interesting thing is we can reduce deforestation and improve the quality of health very dramatically. And these are the people who are doing it, and that's the stove. And you can see the safety posters. Everybody's trained on safety before they can get this stove. And it's quite a complicated product. Looks simple because you have LPG next to an open flame, if you understand what it means. The safety issues are extremely important. So this year they will sell 200,000, next year maybe 1 million. But the more interesting thing is, because it's a global company, piloted in India, scaling in India during this year, and by 2010 it'll have 5 million units, and they're already experimenting in South Africa, and this year they opened up both China and Vietnam. So by 2010, 8 countries will have a very different way of looking at energy for cooking. It's not the solution to all the problems, but it'll dramatically reduce particulate pollution, smoke inhalation, health issues, and dramatically reduce the cost. It's a small effort. But I don't think this could have been invented sitting in New York or Washington or London. You had to go to the villages of India to understand how people do work and how they cook. So I want to come back to this inherent tension. Now, you can look at this and say, yeah, all this is fine, but you're still cutting down forests. It's the same question of 18% interest versus 300% interest. You're destroying 5 kilograms of wood per day, now you do 1. Now, is it better? The answer is yes. But can that be improved? The answer is yes, too. So I think we need to make not one big leap, but small steps. So I look at this and say, what is the only way we can change this ideological battle? Is I think we, all of us, have to think differently. I think it's not about money. I am convinced resources are not the issue. Technology is not the issue. I am convinced mindsets are the issue, the way we think and the way we are socialized. Globalization, bad for the poor, is a traditional view. I think we have to move from can benefit all. Multilaterals, one shoe fits all to multiple solutions, but global standards with local responsiveness and focus on private sector. Civil society, not just local solutions, but locally responsible, scalable solutions, and also work with private sector. I say the elites, that is this group, poor are an intractable problem to say when organized, the poor offer a new solution to poverty. In other words, the most interesting thing for me in all my research is the solution to poverty rests with the poor. If you organize them, mobilize them, motivate them, they can solve their own problems. We just need to mobilize them. Any amount of aid is not going to solve the problem. And I think that's why I believe in Africa, we are creating more dependencies than reliance on themselves. And it's very unfortunate. Private sector, don't ignore the poor. There's a big market there. Government agencies, don't focus on subsidies, but enable the development of market-based ecosystems. Same thing with public view. Private sector cannot be trusted. Did anybody watch Ralph Nader today, saving the world from the big corporation? That's the most fascinating thing I've ever heard. He went on for 2 hours basically saying how the basic large corporation is evil. In a very articulate fashion. So maybe new forms of governance, multinational civil society and governments to work together. I believe the universities have also only focused on the top of the pyramid. Very little work gets done on what happens for 4 billion people, whether it's in health or public policy or whatever. I think the development models where I think we need to do the most. I think current development models are totally inappropriate, so it is possible to marry inclusive growth and ecological stewardship. I believe it is possible to do both. So I'm just going to start by saying we have to imagine a different world. I do not think it's going to happen because of intellect. I think it's going to happen because we can imagine a different world and we have the passion and the courage to create it. And I would also say a lot of humility is in order. We have to learn from the poor. In fact, one thing I've learned is they have more common sense than we think they do. And I've learned a tremendous amount. Every time I go to a village, I come back a much better person. I ask myself, why the hell did I not think that this way? And the reason is I'm educated to reason incorrectly. And they cannot afford to reason badly. They make bad choices, yes. So do we. But there's a lot of reason for humility. For a professor, it's difficult to put intellect last, just about luck. But I really believe it. I think imagination is what we need. So to sum up, I do not believe we can deal with the problems of civilization or ecological sustainability without dealing with the issues of poverty and poverty reduction. These are totally interlinked. Irrespective of how much discussion we have on what the United States should do, which we should have, we should also simultaneously put equal energy in understanding what's happening in developing countries and emerging markets. That's the critical part. Stop here and comments, disagreements, questions. Yes, sir. I think there are examples, a significant number of examples from India, some from Brazil, some from Mexico. So surprisingly, there are no examples from Africa at that time. But that is changing. In fact, I think the most interesting examples today would be from South Africa. A lot of experimentation is going on at grassroots levels, and I think it's only a question of documenting and popularizing it and build role models. The problem in Africa, I think, is each country, if they try to solve their own problems, it is too small. If you have 2 million, 3 million population and not enough educated people and not enough civil society organizations that have been built, it's very hard to do these things. So one of the things that I'm hoping is just like Europe came to the conclusion that the European Union is required, Africa would come to terms with union of multiple countries, maintaining their identity and their separateness, but working together to find solutions that are common. So I can see big three nodes, South Africa, Nigeria, and Egypt, each with a population base of 200 million, to create viable solutions. Now, I know politically we are not there. I'm not naive. But when South Africa experiments and does something interesting, other people will start joining in to replicate those experiments. But you need some scale, not in terms of size of markets, but in size of people who know how to do these things. So Africa, the big problem is capability building, not aid. It's capability building, giving local people the courage to experiment. Whereas I think it's going to happen much faster in Latin America because the size of populations in Mexico or in Brazil. Okay. Yeah, I know you had the, and then I'll come back to you. Yes, sir. I think it started as a CSR, glorified CSR, but now it's getting more and more integrated into the main core business. For example, if I look at Unilever, and the same thing applies to P&G and to Nestle and others, 60% of their business in India is in sachets and go to the poor. So if you 60% of the value of your product is going to the poor, that cannot be outside the realm of the core business. So that's what is happening. And I think the most interesting thing for me is companies like Microsoft are now starting to realize that this market cannot be ignored. And the reason is very simple. When you have all these kiosks and all these people are starting to learn how to use computers and advanced technology, if they all grow up on Linux, that's not a good news. So I think there is more vibrant experimentation going on in Microsoft, for example, than is obvious from the outside. So a lot of companies recognize it, but they want to keep it low-key. But in some companies, it's still very much CSR. I say CSR is a good transition point. You have to learn how to deal with these issues. But if you remain CSR, I have problems. But it's moving rapidly in very many companies, not just a few. Yes, ma'am.
Agriculture showed up, you know, so many places on your slides. Can you comment a little bit on, have there been any success stories of big MNCs getting involved in agriculture? If not, what should they be doing? What role do you think they should play?
I think they have a very significant role to play. If you really look at one of the big paradoxes of agriculture, and I'll again take India as a case in point because I know a little bit about that place, between the farm and the table, there is a between 8 to 11 to 12% wastage. So you, whatever you grow, you don't get to the consumer. And the wastage is quite significant if you look at the size of the country and millions of metric tons. And the reason is most of the investment the government puts in is what I call pre-harvest. They give money and the fertilizers, water, free electricity, and so on. There is absolutely no post-harvest investment, which is refrigeration, logistics, taking stuff from the farmers, taking it to the markets, to the cities. And that, I think, is where the big problems are. And that is where the big American companies are world-class. Take Cargill, for example. That's what they're good at. They don't necessarily grow wheat. They know how to take that stuff from the farmers and take it to global markets at the most cost-efficient fashion. So essentially, I believe some of these countries can grow less and eat better and pay the farmers more. And it is counterintuitive, but at least I know Bill knows this case very well. It is ITC eChopal, which is connecting the farmers with information technology and logistics with one of the Indian companies. They've done it, it's about 2 million farmers now. They pay farmers 8 to 9% more for the same stuff, and they get the products, raw materials, 8 to 9% less because they're eliminating the distribution inefficiencies. I believe there's a huge opportunity here in order to do that. Yes, sir.
Okay, why, in your last comment, are companies keeping things under the radar screen?
One, they're experimenting. They're not sure. Number two, they don't want premature exposure. and the experiment to be stalled, either politically or otherwise. And I think it's the nature of the ideological battleground. I think that's why I say, let's not put the ideological battle under the carpet and say everything is fine. It's not about investment. It's being honest with ourselves on whether we are ideologically focused or not, and what is our ideology, and come to terms with our ideology. And I think this is big. Academics are ideologically oriented, civil society is, multilaterals are, and so are private sector. The managers are not necessarily not ideologically oriented. So we all have to come to terms and we have to solve the problem together, because what is in balance is the quality of life for all of us. The good news about pollution is it knows no borders. And that was brought to me very vividly. I was in Helsinki when Chernobyl happened. It's a total accident that the winds took it to northern Sweden. But everything in the supermarkets had to be thrown away for a week. And you get stuck. Nobody would land in Helsinki. And you get stuck there. You learn very fast. Borders mean nothing. And we better understand that fast. Bill?
One of the connections you didn't emphasize is the ability of the intellectual power of our universities, if connected,
exactly,
to the needs of the bottom of the pyramid, to make dramatic progress. I know there's a new program with Stanford and the All Institute of Indian Medicine and many other such programs. I think that that is another way changing the mindset.
Yeah,
the mindset that high technology can be used for low tech applications, and many of the technologies that are in our universities can be transferred if they're sensitive to the needs and meeting the needs of the people.
I fully agree. In fact, I'm a one man band in Michigan to say that we should use our intellectual horsepower in public policy, public health, and biotechnologies and medicine and experiment at the bottom of the pyramid and teach them how to improve their lives in a different way. And I think it's going to happen, because a lot of people, it's all about building enough momentum and a tipping point where people start thinking that we have an obligation much bigger than ourselves. And I think it's going to happen. It's only a matter of time. And I fully agree with you. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. I'm a fellow member of WRI's board and share your passion for mangroves, but I wanted to go back to that great slide where you talk about the economics. If I'm a owner of a mangrove area in Thailand, I can look on your slide and see, and I'm convinced as somebody who worries about these things, that the best thing to do with the mangrove area is to leave it intact so that it provides the fishery benefit, it provides the storm, hurricane, typhoon benefit. Those are common goods, though. If I'm the landowner, I'm still getting the subsidy from the Thailand government. I'm still getting the income from the fisheries, and I don't pay personally for the cleanup afterwards. So how do you work the economics so that the owner of the mangrove area says, I got it, I'm going to leave my plants in place?
You know, I think it's a very important question, because not only it's public good versus private good, but more in terms of time frames as well. The destruction of mangrove and therefore destruction of coastal areas may happen, may not happen. That's all in the future. Whereas money from making shrimp is today, and I can understand it. One of the things that I think we want to do is, in public policy, is in subsidizing developmental work. We need to start getting this total cost picture so that we understand upfront as public policymakers where to provide the subsidies and where not to provide the subsidies. In other words, you can incent a whole variety of industries, and we just chose to do the easy one. And the question is, are there alternatives to finding employment, improving the lives of people? Not necessarily saying the easy one is to give guys who can go and build these shrimp farms, 5 years later abandon and go on to the next mangrove forest. And I think we need to understand what the total costs are. And public policy has been not very oriented towards total costs. And the second is understanding what the remediation is going to look like and build that into the cost. In other words, if somebody gets a subsidy, take a part of the profit into remediation, and then people get that information very fast. It's exactly what we had to do. Companies polluted the rivers, and now EPA says, you clean it up. And I can tell you, everybody now is a little bit more sensitive of dumping stuff in the river, right? And for those who dumped the stuff 30 years ago, they're still liable. Now, we can probably enforce it. You can't enforce it in mangrove forests. But taking part of the profit or making it a price for remediation, creating a separate fund for remediation, may also help people understand that this is not a free ride. So we have to change the perspectives and the incentives. And that's not going to be easy politically. But the choices are, if several groups get together and build a consensus, it's possible to do. If you just let the government do it, it will not. Civil society, private sector, buyers in this country, most of the shrimp comes here. Buyers in this country can enforce significant pressure on these people, just like we did with Nike on human rights. We can do that stuff if we want to. I believe the best is the pressure from the consumers. If you don't buy that stuff and it has to be certified that mangrove forest will not be destroyed or remediation will take place, I think people will respond to it. So the markets have a wonderful way of regulating this. So I believe that we have a huge obligation to put pressure back. Yes, ma'am. I think the income inequality in most countries, the large countries, the small countries, if it's Singapore, it's very different. On the other hand, if you're China or India, the problems are different. It's regional income inequalities. It's ethnic. It's even within a state between rural and urban. So the income inequalities is an asymmetric way in which development takes place. The coastal provinces of China is getting very rich. But if you go to the inner provinces, it's not. I can draw a northwest line in India. The west of India is moving very rapidly forward. In fact, it's called the famous Kanpur line. Take one of the cities and draw a northwest line. East of it is in real bad shape. So the income inequalities is across states, tribal areas versus rural areas versus urban areas. So the question, I think, is, how do you get the distribution of work? How do you get the subsistence farmers to participate in global economy? And that is use of information technology and use of logistics so that people can do it. When I say use of information technology, it looks like far-fetched. But if you look at the experiments where this is working, all of them are based on integral use of information technology because people can be connected without necessarily moving. And the other question which is quite important for us is the patterns of urbanization. China recognizes urbanization will take place, or they're trying to cope with it. In India, urbanization takes place, and nobody wants to deal with this huge problem. And I think in India, 1 million people in a city is nothing. It's a small city. And urbanization brings with it its own problems. All of Africa, urbanization is huge problems. So, and I agree with you, I think part of it is really building networks, information networks, logistics networks that connect people in different ways so that they don't have to move, and prosperity will happen across the whole area. But it's not going to be an easy process. It's going to be a 50-year process. And we have to balance social development and economic development. And that's what you see happening in India and China. Everybody says it's a muddling through. I said yes, by design. You have no choice. If you push one too hard, the other will suffer. So, and that's why we need some wisdom rather than just intellect, knowing how far you can push any one of those things. I know you had a question.
Well, it's related to the last question, but I wasn't going to press it, but I will have another go at the inequality issue. You dwelt at great length on inequality in the first part of your talk, and I wondered if you didn't need to make a sharper distinction between poverty and inequality for exactly the reason the lady over here just said. Rural incomes in China are actually increasing right now at 6% a year, the fastest in history. China is dealing with poverty. Poverty in China is falling, but inequality is rising.
That's
not
right.
Because of what's happening at the bottom, because of what's happening at the top. If all your excellent advice, and I want to say I agree with everything you say about attacking poverty, if we did all that, it wouldn't solve the problem of rising inequality in China and India.
Yeah, in fact, I think one of the things that is fascinating for me is I agree with you, but there are ways in which you can deal with inequality. One is to make sure you slow down the engine of growth so nobody gets rich as fast. Tax them as much as you can. There are many ways, and India has tried every one of them, and China has tried every one of them too. So if you look at the numbers that I showed you, the Gini coefficient with China was 22. It's now at 47. It may go up to 50. So I think one of the interesting things is rapid economic development will create income inequalities because the benefits are asymmetric and it does not percolate through the whole system immediately. And that has happened in our country as well. That is Charles Dickens' novels in the UK. So it is not as if it has not happened. The problem is it is so compressed in China and India in such a short period of time. Within one people's memory, they can see all this. Suddenly your neighbor is very rich coming from the same village and you're not. That is the problem. So social tensions are coming not only because of poverty. Actually, when everybody was poor, there was not as much social tension. When income inequalities creates a different dynamic. And I think one of the things that people are doing is including slowing down, including forcing the redistribution of some wealth, creating the ability for rural economies to develop by providing subsidies. In India, for example, they guarantee 100 days worth of work. I know one thing that will happen. 100 days worth of work doesn't mean people get 100 days wages. They may get 20 days wages and somebody else will get rich. But at least 20 days wages are better than nothing. So there are all kinds of, and both in India and China, this is the top political priority. The Chinese call it harmonized society. What, that's a code word for saying we can't deal with this crisis.
But the problem in my mind is if we in the West are monitoring the progress of this venture by looking at statistics on inequality, we may get the wrong idea about what's happening.
That's
many
right.
People are very, very pessimistic about global poverty because they look at the inequality statistics.
Okay.
And I think that is an error. You have to look at poverty full on and see what's happening there.
Yeah, that is why I started by saying income inequality, upward mobility are two different things from inequalities themselves. Moving from abject poverty is not enough, but that's a good start.
Last question.
Yep. Yes, sir.
There are various global entities that could theoretically be part of the solution here, vis-a-vis the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, etc. Do you think they're so fatally flawed in the way they think about these issues that they can't contribute or vice versa or something in between?
I have less and less I have to say it carefully, but anyway, I don't have to say it carefully. I think the World Bank has its own problems to deal with internally now. I think the next 2 years, nothing much is going to happen. They have to get their internal issues in order. And the UN is too fragmented to build a consensus on these issues. For example, they built the Millennium Development Goals. Private sector was not even part of it. 4 years later, they thought of the private sector, and I was in that commission. And it was like pulling teeth to commit to private sector as a player, not the total solution, as a player to these issues. So I think it's so ideologically bound, and there is a developmental model that is ideologically bound. So I think the world has moved away much faster. If you really think about it, China and India are the two countries which violated everything that we told them to do, including the Washington Consensus, right? They didn't go and privatize everything in a hurry. They said, we'll do it our way. They seem to be doing okay. You can see what happened in Latin America. In other words, you cannot change institutions as fast as you can change the ideology overtly. Russia is a particularly interesting case. It almost became bankrupt with the solutions that had nothing to do with institution building and capability building. You don't create market mechanisms without institutions. So it's a slow process. And I believe that each country has to find its own model, especially the large countries like Brazil and Mexico and South Africa. The smaller countries are better off to reduce the amount of dependence on aid and escape the curse of natural resources. Few people get rich. Everything looks good. I think actually resource-starved countries are doing much better. So I think we need to eliminate the, somehow reduce the dependence on natural resources and subsidies and handouts. And I think we have to say, it's the good old American way, depend on yourself, depend on your own ingenuity and creativity. And that is what my argument is. You can take everybody's help, but you have to do it yourself. And but I'm very hopeful and very optimistic. And thank you for coming.